Dew line. When I was in Barrow during the Cold War, I had George with me. He's just a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in September 1954.
Okay.
So 1957, I came down from Barrow. I still had George. And I was pregnant with Libby.
Okay.
So that I lived in Fairbanks after that. I went back up to Camp Lonely
mm-hmm.
one winter just for a job.
What did you do there?
I did general camp work and office work. Kept track of the daily cat trains and the daily personnel locations. Handled a lot of secretarial work.
Mm-hmm.
They had very, very slim staff.
Yeah.
Not many.
I just want to quickly say that today is November 16th, 2018, and this is Karen Brewster here with Kathleen, Mike Dalton, and her daughter Libby. So we're continuing to talk about Dew Line and Barrow and...
And spruce trees in my yard.
Spruce trees. That's what we were talking about before the recorder was on. So
when we first cleared this land, there were no spruce trees. None.
Wow.
They're all volunteer.
Hmm. So you think by clearing it, it gave them a way to
It gave them a lot of ground for nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
If you have cottonwoods around them, it just sucks up the... the nutrition out of the soil.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So I didn't plan it that way. That's just a learning lesson for me. And a lot of my trees I have named.
You named the trees?
Name your trees.
Oh, good.
Why not?
Yeah, so what are some of the names?
Well, let's see. Start this little clump here. We didn't select trees. Maybe I'll just select them for
mm-hmm.
Scott.
How about that one on the far left? That one looks healthy in that little clump
in
there.
That little clump.
Yeah, we'll name that for Scott. Pick one for Suzanne.
Oh,
we had some visitors yesterday, and we were going to give them a name for their tree.
Oh.
Scott and Suzanne? Okay. Scott Hawkins and Suzanne Downey. And then weren't you going to name one Crystal McQuestern?
Yeah. I can't see it from
here.
Or did
you already name that one?
It's already named.
So do you name them in honor of people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just in memory of.
In memory of? Oh, that's nice.
Special people I've known.
Yeah.
So you better pick one if you want one. And if you look, this big clump here, big tree.
Right.
It's actually two,
yeah.
Three. And then right behind it, down the hill a ways,
yeah.
Is Crystal McQuestern tree.
That's a nice one.
Mm-hmm.
Crystal McQuestern Morgan.
Okay.
She's Jack McQuestern's daughter, whom I met in Berkeley.
And Jack McQuestern, was he an old miner?
Yep. One of the first...
Mostly he was a... He ran trading posts.
Okay.
He was a trader mostly.
Okay.
He came in 1873... with Harper and Mayo.
Okay. Yeah, that name was familiar to me.
Jack McQuestern.
McQuestern.
They had 11 kids. 8 survived. And Crystal was like down the line, maybe.
She was born in 1891.
Oh.
1891?
Mm-hmm.
You sure it was 1891? It was June 21st. I remember that. I thought it was 1890. It was 1891. Because she was 5 years old when he left in
1896.
Yeah.
Well, then.
He established trading posts at Circle and at 40 Mile. And when the big stampede started into the Klondike, he anticipated a big stampede. And he knew that his trading post would be wiped out by the stampeders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Crystal told me this. So he decided he was going to take his whole family out of state.
Oh.
Where they'd be safe and had food, could survive.
Yeah.
So he'd been out in California before, because most of those fellows, before they married, came, and then if they got a gold pouch full of gold, they decided to leave for the winter.
Right.
You know, go to California like some of our people now.
Yeah.
So some of them up in that area and over here would go down the coast and they'd find places they liked real well, like San Jose and and maybe the Pacific Northwest. So he had been down in that area, so he wanted to take his family out and put them in a real nice area where they could live without his, so his, you know, without his presence.
Right.
He was mainly afraid of starvation.
Yeah.
Hard times because of the stampede.
Yeah, there'd be no food left in his trading post.
Right.
Because they were headed for the Klondike, which is another 100 miles up the river.
So she was born June 21st, 1891, in a tent outside their cabin.
At 40 Mile.
At
40 Mile.
Wow. There's still a trading post building there.
Yeah, at 40 Mile.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you first meet Crystal McQuesten?
Well, I had heard about her, that she was still alive, so I called one of the people I knew in Seattle with the Alaska Yukon Pioneers, see if they had an address for her, and they did. So I talked to two of my friends, Alaska Link and Vuka Stepovich, and we were buddies. We'd do things together, get in up my pickup camper and go have an adventure. So I said, well, one of them already knew Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had been members of the San Francisco Sourdoughs. So the other friend here, Alaska Link, wanted to meet her because she was really tuned into history.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, her birthday is the 21st of June. Why don't we go to 40 Mile and have a birthday party? And my one friend, Vil, Mike, where's 40 Mile? So I told them, they said, okay, they'd do it. They asked me how we'd get to her. We talked about it a lot. You know, they'd come out here and we'd get together and meet and talk about it. So they thought it was okay. So we hired a fellow in Eagle. We didn't know him, we just knew of him. He was a pretty good guide. He'd worked for BLM, Park Service. So he was equipped with float boats and tents and everything you needed. So we contacted him and we set up a date to meet him at the bridge that went across the 40 Mile River. A lot of bridges go across 40 Mile. Anyway, we got there at a certain time. He got there right on time, drove up with all of his equipment. We brought our own tents and cooking equipment and food. He furnished some of it. But we had it all worked out before we took the trip. And we got in the water on the 40 Mile River, about 40 miles up from the Yukon,
because
it comes right into the Yukon above Eagle. About 50 miles above Eagle. And so we went there. We had no idea there were serious rapids in the 40 Mile River until we got in. So he before we got there, he said, I hope you ladies aren't afraid of rapids because we're going to go into, oh no, we're not, well, that's fine. Keep going. Well, we went in there and we bounced up and down. There were serious rapids. And mosquitoes were horrible.
Yeah.
And so we camped out that night, went down and found a nice campsite. And then the next day, we went on down to 40 Mile and camped there for 2 days. Took a lot of pictures.
Neat.
Cooked over a campfire, made our own bread. I took a wash pan about that big in diameter. I took some yeast and flour. I had plenty of water out of the river. and salt, everything you needed for bread. So when we got there, I mixed up some dough for bread. We didn't have an oven. We made fry bread.
Yeah.
Which is delicious.
It is.
And then we had a lot of bacon, and I used the bacon grease for fry bread. And, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Bacon grease fry bread. Try that if you're going camping again. But it was so good.
That sounds delicious.
And then my friend Alaska used it for washing her socks later.
The bacon grease?
No, you used the pan.
Oh, the pan.
And then for the rest of the trip, she kept kidding us about washing, that I used her wash basin to make bread. That she, it was hers, she said, for her feet and for her socks. So anyway, mosquitoes were terrible.
Yeah.
But you know, when you're living the conditions are rough and you have good company or good sports and good food, you don't mind it. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, that sounds like a fun trip.
It was.
So I want to, you at the beginning you mentioned working at Camp Lonely. Can I take us back there?
Mm-hmm.
Just to finish that.
So, that was Department of Interior went back up there and started cleaning up some of the mess left by the Navy.
Oh, okay.
It already had a cleanup, but they went up there and were doing some more drilling for oil. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about that. I don't know much about that at all.
So what year were you there?
1982, I think.
Oh, okay. So what did you do with your kids? Did they come with you?
No, they were grown by then. No, I go back on that. It was 1978. It was the year Ann Stevens died.
And so 1978 is when you went up to Lonely?
Yes.
Okay. And how long were you there?
I was there just that one winter. And Ann Stevens died in a plane crash.
Right.
In December 78.
Okay.
I was a pallbearer.
Oh, you were a good friend of hers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I worked for her husband for 7 years.
Okay.
And she would come up from time to time, so I worked with her on trips and transportation.
Can I ask you a favor?
Mm-hmm.
To not move the coffee cup around?
My coffee's making too much noise.
Your coffee's making too much noise.
Did you bring me this?
No, Libby brought you that.
The admission to my house is some gossip.
Okay.
This is this phase of my life.
Okay.
A little bit of gossip so I can have something new to think about.
Right.
And since you're with university, I'd like to get some university gossip.
Okay.
And, or a 12-ounce Americano coffee.
Okay. I'll remember that.
You remember that?
I will remember that.
Oh, good girl.
It's just if the sliding it around on the tabletop.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
So
my visitors yesterday, they met the standard. They brought me, they bring me coffee.
They brought you a little gossip.
What if you bring coffee and gossip?
That's good. That's very good.
Double.
Anyway, they gave me some real juicy gossip. I told them what the admission price was.
Okay.
But I beat them, though, on the gossip, didn't I?
Well, we won't talk about it on tape.
Yeah, we won't talk about it.
Right my story was a lot better than her story.
Maybe.
But well, I'm not going to tell it.
No, we don't want to talk about that.
But they met the standard.
Okay. Well, I hadn't been informed prior to today of those requirements, so I'll make sure the next time.
No, you don't have to.
So do you want to talk more, do you want to talk about those 7 years working for Senator Stevens?
Yeah, I guess I will. I worked for him until, I started working for him about the 1st of April, 1972, I think. I had worked for the News Miner for 10 years, and I quit there on the 1st of April, 1970. 1970, yeah. And then I didn't do anything but try to mind my own business, be a housewife and my mother for a couple years. And then I got a telephone call one day from Senator Stevens here at the house. He said, "I'm coming to town next week. I wanted to meet with you." I said, "Okay, what's up?" He said, "Oh, I'll tell you when I get there."
So you already had known him before that?
I had met him, yes.
Okay.
Because he was a special friend of Mr. Snedden, who was a publisher.
Oh, that's right.
At the Newsminer.
That's right.
And I had met him.
Okay.
And I was also active in his campaign. He he ran for the U.S. Senate in 1962.
Okay.
And did not make it.
Who made it? Bartlett?
I'm not sure.
Bartlett,
I think, or Greening.
Greening. Okay, Bartlett was already senator.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he did not get elected.
Right.
Most people don't know he ran in 62. But he needed to establish himself in Alaska a little bit. So 4 years later, he ran again in 1968. And he won the nomination. Republican nomination,
mm-hmm.
and went on to win the nomination to the U.S. He did not. Bartlett won it. Bartlett protected his seat.
Bartlett was the Democrat, so.
Yes. The two Democrat senators were Ernest Greening and Bob Bartlett.
So Stevens won the Republican primary, but then he didn't win the final election in November.
No, he didn't.
Okay.
He ran against Elmer Rasmussen in the primary.
Oh, that's right. And he beat Rasmussen. I knew, yeah.
And then he did not win. Elmer won, but he didn't make it through the general.
Right.
That was in November of
68. Okay.
Well, Senator Bartlett was ill. I mean, it had been discussed several times in the campaign that he was ill. He had a declining heart.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted to lose Bartlett.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. So we knew he was ill. But in cases like that, you just wait to see what happens.
Right.
It may take a year, 2 years, 10 years. So anyway, Ted ran against...
So Bartlett won that 68 election?
Bartlett was nominated. No, he wasn't up for election.
Oh.
Let me think a minute.
I know he died, and then Stevens was appointed, right?
Yes. He died in office.
Yeah.
And Ted Stevens was appointed by Walter Hickel as the Republican nominee.
Wait,
no, not Republican nominee.
To become the senator?
That was in December he appointed.
Right.
In November, I'm trying to think.
Well, I know all that history's written down.
Yeah.
That part's known about all the political campaigns and stuff. So let's go to him meeting
then
with you.
Bartlett was still in office.
Mm-hmm.
And Gravel was in that race also.
Senator Bartlett passed away December 11th, 1968. Ted Stevens was appointed to the U.S. Senate in December 1968 to fill the vacancy by Walter Hickel, governor.
Okay.
Just happened to have him.
Thanks, Libby.
What are you reading from, Libby?
The Alaska State Legislature roster of members.
It's a list of all the legislators.
Oh, cool.
Territorial days.
Good.
Really handy book.
You get it from somebody in the legislature.
Yeah. Handy reference book. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So Ted had run in the
So he got appointed in 68.
Yeah. But Gravel ran in that general and won. Well, he'd already defeated Elmer Rasmussen, I think.
Well, I know that there was a time where Stevens and Gravel served side by side. They were both in office at the same time at some point.
Yeah, right, that at that time.
Okay.
Anyway, Stevens got appointed in 68.
And then he and called you...
Gravel had defeated Greening in the primary. Although the general was Bartlett and Gravel.
And Gravel was the Democratic nominee, and he won the election.
Yeah.
So he was the Democratic senator, and Stevens became the Republican senator after Bartlett died.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And then he had to fill out Bartlett's. Bartlett was not in the general.
Right.
He still had 2 or 4 years to fill out his term.
Okay.
And Ted ran for that, and Bartlett won. People in Alaska love Bartlett.
Yeah.
You know, he's a gold miner from Circle area. Just a good old guy. Really, really nice man. Mm-hmm. Good man.
And you think he did a good job as senator?
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed. Nobody wanted to see Bartlett go.
Mm-hmm. So, Ted Stevens had big shoes to fill.
Big shoes, yeah. But Ted was well educated for it when he went in.
Mm-hmm.
So he went in, and he was a senator, and Gravel was a senator.
Right.
Until December 11th. And Bartlett, and well, let's see, it was Gravel and Bartlett, and then it was just Gravel from December 11th to the end of the term.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't affect Gravel's standing at all. But we had only one senator there for a while.
Right.
And of course, some of the people had been involved with the Republican Party. It had to be a Republican. No, it didn't have to be a Republican. It had to be somebody the Republican Party recommended. So all these people who had dreams of being a United States Senator came crawling out of the woodwork wanting them to be appointed, and Governor Hickel appointed Ted. And I was amazed because they had a serious falling out.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Back in 1964. Wally Hickel was the national committee man, and he had spent years and lots of dollars fighting for statehood.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1964, at that convention of the Republican Party in Juneau, they had a real serious falling out right there on the floor of the convention.
Wow.
So people were really surprised when he appointed Ted. And I talked to Governor Hickel about that one time, and I told him I had been working for Ted for a long time, and I was really interested in why he appointed Ted to that vacant Senate seat and not Carl Brady, for example, or his brother, or somebody, Mike Stepovich, or some, John Butrovich, or somebody from Fairbanks. He said, well, he was the best man for the job. He said, I was looking for somebody who would represent Alaska fairly and equitably. He said Ted knew more about what was going on, was more qualified for that job than anybody who had his name before me. So that's what happened.
Well, and Ted had won the primary over Elmer Rasmussen, so that would make sense.
Gravel won the...
No, the Republican primary.
No.
In August, didn't...
No, Elmer Rasmussen won.
Oh, that's right, that's right. Okay.
Ted was defeated.
Oh, that's right.
He ran for Senate twice and was defeated in the primary.
Okay, so he got appointed and he started serving.
He got appointed, and I forget the date, but it was late December.
Mm-hmm.
of 68. So he goes back there and fills the seat of Bartlett. So he was a senior senator by that time. Because he was filling the senior senator.
So even if you're a new senator, you fill a senior senator's seat?
If you're filling the seat, you fill the requirements of that seat.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So he was a senior senator, though he hadn't been sworn in yet. So anyway, that kind of settled out. We had two senators duly elected, and he was filling out Bartlett's term,
right,
which was 2 years.
And at that point, you were still working for the News Miner, the Daily News Miner,
yeah,
in Fairbanks? Yeah, you were a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were following all this?
I was reporting on the Arctic then.
Okay.
A lot on the Arctic. Because I was the only one on the staff who had been above the Arctic Circle. And
because oil was discovered in 68, the big...
Yeah, the big oil was discovered in 68. So
March
they were,
of 68,
so they,
yeah,
were interested in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
The newspaper was interested in the Arctic.
Oh, yeah.
Because of oil?
Oh, yeah. We had in 69, we had the lease sales,
mm-hmm,
for $900 million.
For the Prudhoe Bay area leases?
Mm-hmm. So that put us on the map, petroleum map of the world.
Yeah.
So Ted ran for the remainder of Bartlett's seat, 2 years to fill that out.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been 60, let's see.
70.
No. He had two years left in the term.
Well, if he was appointed... 68.
Mm-hmm.
He had 2 more years. That would be 70, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Or 72. That would be 4 years. Anyway.
He was elected in 68, so that meant he served 69 and 70.
Okay.
Bartlett's term, 60,
okay,
finishing out 69, 70.
Okay.
So Bartlett's term was up in 70, so Ted ran in 70.
Mm-hmm.
And was elected.
And the other senator was Mike Gravel.
Yeah, and Gravel.
I think that's your phone, Libya, here.
I know, I'm ignoring it.
Okay.
Gravel had won the primary because he defeated Green.
Right. Okay, so now we have Stevens in office and he's serving out the term.
Mm-hmm.
And then.
So sometime in 1970, he called me here at home and I've been active in his campaign, his campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And was kind of a member of a group here in town who considered itself the Ted Stevens Social Group. And when he was available, they put together a fundraiser or a big rally of some kind. You know what, a campaigner's appearance, events.
Right.
So I knew him and he knew me, and I think it was Snedden who recommended me to the position.
Right.
He needed somebody in Fairbanks to staff an office. And so he came to town and we set up a lunch date. So I went to Travelers Inn, which is right where the Westmark,
uh-huh,
is now. Sat down with him for lunch and he said, "Well, I want you to go to work for me." I said, "You do? Why?" "Well," he said, "I need somebody here and you fill the bill for me," or something like that. So we talked, and I said, "I've never worked in a Senate office. I don't know what goes on. What do you want me to do for you?" He said, "You will know what I need, because you're here at Fairbanks, and you've been working for the newspaper." So I knew all the drunks on Second Avenue and all the crooked attorneys in town, and I just knew a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of Native people. I had been elected to membership of the Fairbanks Native Association in 65.
Oh.
As an honorary member.
Okay.
So they were working hard on the land claims, so we needed somebody here who could translate what the Natives were saying at their powwows and get what, you know, their messages back to Ted.
Mm-hmm.
Just, well, you know what I'm talking about. It's just a lot going on.
Yeah. He needed somebody who knew the issues and knew the people.
And knew the territory.
And knew how to talk to people.
And knew the people, yeah. So he had talked to over in the post office building. Which, oh, I'm sorry, I'm moving my coffee
cup. I'm going to move the microphone, so then it'll still be a problem, but less of a problem. Okay.
You should have yelled at me.
No. We'll make it work.
Well, my coffee cup will sit there, and I won't move it now.
Now that I moved the mic, yeah. Okay, so you had your lunch with Ted, and you took the job.
Yeah, sure. I was honored to be even considered. A lot of people in town would have filled the spot, I thought. So I said, well, where's your office? He said, I don't have one. So he says, I'm going to go talk to the U.S. Marshal, and the federal judge up in the post office building, see if there's room in that building. So he did. He talked to the marshal. And they had a small office adjoining his office that was used for visiting marshals or visiting federal people who needed a temporary place to land in town. So we went there and talked to him. They said, yeah, you can, this is fine. It was just a nice little office fit, one desk fitted in there and a small bookcase. And the only piece of equipment is before fax, before internet, before long distance phones, before email. There was an old Royal typewriter there. And so the first time I had some clients, I sat down to type their name and address and get going on the problem. And the typewriter and the ribbon were so old that when I first typed on it, it just blew up into a cloud. Just, it really did.
Where did the typewriter come from?
It had been left over.
It was just in that Marshal's office?
Marshal's office, yeah. They had just kind of outfitted the office for visitors.
Yeah.
It had been there for years. But that ribbon just blew up in the cloud.
Wow.
Fell apart.
That was in the federal building?
Mm-hmm.
Did it look like it does now?
The federal building? Mm-hmm.
They did some remodeling inside, but not outside.
Well, you mean the big federal building that's down on
2nd and Cushman?
The one between 2nd and 3rd Avenue on Cushman Street.
Oh, yeah, okay, the old federal building.
The old federal building. So that started my career with Ted. So I was working for the News Miner one day and Ted the next day.
Well, there may have been, were there some similarities in the jobs?
Not many.
No.
But I, by that time, had covered the beginnings of a road to the Arctic. The state of Alaska put together a cat train and a crew and headed north.
Mm-hmm.
And they got as far as Livengood, just a little past Livengood, 1970. Before anybody could do anything to develop up there, they needed a pipeline to get the product out. And that was during our oil shortage.
Mm-hmm.
OPEC turned off the faucet to us. And they kept pumping, but we didn't. We had not established an oil field by then. The only thing they knew for any positive knowledge was from what Arctic contractors had done in the Navy from 45 to 57.
Mm-hmm. Well, to get that pipeline built, they had to get a road in to get the materials up there, right?
Well, Lonely didn't have anything to do with Prudhoe.
No, for Prudhoe, you were talking about the road. So they had to get the road built to Prudhoe so they could build the pipeline,
so they
can
haul supplies,
right.
and they got started. The state decided to give it a boost and have a cat train haul some of the stuff up. And they had to get a lot of permits from the federal government. And by then, the Saudi Arabia decided to turn the faucet off for the world.
Mm-hmm.
They maintained their high production for them.
So did that put pressure on getting Prudhoe developed faster?
Yes, it did. We were paying $4 for or so for a gallon of gas. It shut off the oil supply to the world.
Right. I remember big lines at the gas stations because it was rationed. And
OPEC is, what is that?
Oil producing, exporting countries, something like that.
I don't know. I know it, but...
I used to know it, but I'm guessing. Oil producing and exporting countries, that's OPEC.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, something like that.
That's close.
So the haul road, then the state did that first part, and then did the companies, the oil companies did the rest of it?
No.
It was all the state?
State did.
Okay.
State and the oil companies. They formed a coalition, which they named Alaska Pipeline.
Okay.
Made up of the major drillers, major producers, and the state.
Okay.
And the feds, they were involved too, because a lot of the money that went into that road was federal money.
Well, it went over federal land.
Yeah.
At that stage.
They had to get permits for every little bush it crossed over. And every little stream. Or if they knocked a bird nest out of those trees, you know, they had to get all kinds of...
Well, that was the beginning of the National Environmental Protection Act, NEPA.
That's why...
And they had to go through all that.
That's why they closed it down.
NEPA?
Environmentalists got to Congress. Said, you can't do that. And they had environmentalists all over the nation stirred up against the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time OPEC withdrew its ban, they got Congress involved.
Middle East oil embargo begins October 1973.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you who started EPA. It was Richard Nixon. And
yeah, that was in the 60s, mm-hmm. I think.
Anyway, those were stressful days.
Yeah.
First for the state because they had no income.
Right.
And
now, the haul road now is named the Dalton Highway after your husband.
Yes.
But he didn't have anything to do with that.
No, he did not. He was working up in the Arctic, doing work for exploratory work for Phillips Petroleum and Colorado Oil and Gas, mostly out of Umiak.
Okay.
There's gas discovered up there. Out of Umiak, there's an oil structure called Gubik, G-U-B-I-K.
I've heard of it.
And they were over there developing that. It's a huge, big gas supply. They were over working on that discovery.
Okay. So why did they name the Dalton Highway?
I don't know. There was a senator named Charlie Parr who proposed naming it the Dalton Highway in 1980. And he submitted a resolution to the Senate, State Senate, requesting the governor to sign it, naming that road after James W. Dalton. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened with the resolution. It passed both houses, but it got to Governor Hammond's desk, and he wouldn't sign it. He could sign it. It could become law.
Do you know why he wouldn't sign it?
No, never did. Find out. He was indebted to the environmentalists for a lot of things, mainly getting elected second time.
Who's that, Mom?
Hammond.
Governor Hammond. So maybe Parr suggested naming it for your husband just because he had been doing so much in the North and had been helping with
exploration. He knew of Jim Dalton, but they didn't know each other.
Well, but he knew of what he'd accomplished.
He wanted...
But so you...
He wanted to name it after someone who had proven himself in the Arctic.
Right. And your husband, James Dalton, didn't have anything to do with the oil at Prudhoe.
No, he didn't. He didn't work for any of the majors or the state. His contribution was the knowledge of what he had done. Like, he knew if he had to go to a certain place like Camp Lonely or Powell Wonson, and they didn't have any, he knew how to get communications to that spot. He knew how to get equipment, drilling equipment and mud, stuff they needed.
And he knew what people to hire.
Oh, yeah.
He knew all the guys.
And he knew a lot about permafrost.
Yeah.
He was a graduate in mining engineering.
Right.
So he had a lot of engineering skills.
And what year did he pass away?
1977.
Okay. So he was here for when Prudhoe was getting up and going.
Well, he was used as a consultant in and out of administrations.
Okay.
A lot of the people up here were involved in oil knew him.
Well, that's why I think that's why they maybe suggested naming the road after
him. Because I had nothing to do with it.
He definitely made a contribution.
I didn't know that Senator Parr was even thinking about it until next year it happened.
Right.
Then in 1981 session, Senator Parr came back, and he presented the same idea as a statute in the statute form. So then it passed the legislature and went to the governor, and he signed it then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad that you finally got a sign up. I can't believe there was never a sign explaining who the highway was named for. That's just amazing.
I've made at least 26 trips up there.
Yeah.
And I look for it at first. The first time I became really aware of it was about the 10th time I'd been over the road. I was by myself. I stopped at the river where there's a Kia or a platform, BLM at a platform and an information place. Well, it's a very nice platform. And I went up on it and sat down, and I could see a plaque over here. And I could see a plaque. Over there I could see a plaque. So I went and looked at them. They were all for Ed Patton for the bridge.
Oh, right.
I looked and looked and looked. There was nothing there. So every time I went up, I kept looking for some kind of interpretive. Even the government house up there, what is it, or information.
Oh, like the Visitors
Center? Visitors Bureau.
Oh, yeah.
They had nothing.
At Coldfoot, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had nothing. They knew nothing.
Yeah. That's a shame. Sounds like he made great contributions to our state.
And so, that was in 1981.
Right.
He signed it. It became law. In the meantime, it was closed to the public.
Right.
If you wanted to drive to Prudhoe, you had to be an official of Alaska or state. But if you could convince the people in the state that you had a legitimate reason for going up, they'd give you
a permit.
A permit to go through the security. So I did that several times.
What were your legitimate reasons? Do you remember?
I didn't have any legitimate reasons. I just told them I wanted to go.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of my life up there. My husband did too, and I want to go. And they named it after him. Why not let me go?
Yeah.
So the first trip I made was in 75.
And so did you go up and do business for Senator Stevens up there?
Sometimes I did. I went to, when you go to camp like that, and you're representing the senator, you at least go knock on the door and say, I'm here and this is what I'm doing. Because mm-hmm. they're interested in what the hell is Stephen sending somebody up here for.
Yeah.
I wasn't up there to spy or anything. Just introduced myself. I didn't have any problem.
Yeah. So when you worked for Senator Stevens, what kind of things did you do? You said when you started, you know, he said, well, you'll figure out, you'll know what to do. So yeah. What kind of things did you do?
Well, the first clients I had in the office were four...
veterans?
No. Allison Air Force Airmen. One of them was real fat. The other three were not. But they came to back him up because he was contesting the Air Force rule that if you were too fat, went over the limit, they didn't want you. They wanted you to leave. He wanted to stay in the Air Force even though he was over the poundage, too much poundage. So, you know, I knew what the Air Force, I found out what the Air Force rule was. So I'll do what I can, but I don't think we're going to change the Air Force rule. I never saw him again, so no. I guess he left.
So that counts as constituent relations or something, right?
Hmm?
That counts as constituent work?
Oh, yeah.
That's what that's called, yeah.
A lot of that.
Isn't that what primarily the job was?
Yeah.
To represent?
Ted Stevens' office in Fairbanks.
Yeah. So people could come and give their concerns and you'd pass it on.
Yeah, I'd type it up and I'd pass it on to Senator Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, we got a new typewriter.
Yeah.
What about the fellow with the veterans problem? I remember you telling the story about a man that came in that had a problem with his veteran benefits.
Oh, yeah. That was in later, 75 or 76 or something. They built a new federal building, so we had to move.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I had a lot of those, Libby.
So what, do you remember what that story is? A particular one about a veteran benefit?
What?
Do you remember a particular story about...
That she's referring to?
Yeah.
They were giving him the runaround.
No, it was, he wasn't veteran. He was a federal employee.
Okay.
And this is kind of typical. He came in and introduced himself real polite. And he had a problem with the Department of Labor. He had appealed. They had a problem somewhere where he was working. He appealed, and they ruled in his favor, but they never came through.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived out there, and he says, you know, I have fuel bill and grocery bill, and they approved my contest. So I said, well, maybe I can call the Department of Labor for you. So that's typical of what would mm-hmm. happen, cases that came in.
And were you successful?
And, yeah, it was within an hour or so. They'd reached the end of the rope in their appeals to the government. We didn't have fax machines yet, had no internet. We competed for telephone lines out of Alaska. At that time, the federal, the federal government, the one telephone line we had competed with six other. In the state of Alaska, by that time, Gravel had his office there too.
Mm-hmm.
And the BLM and the Veterans Affairs, Ted's office, Gravel's office, and a couple other, like Weather Bureau,
uh-huh.
that's five, competed for a telephone line out of Alaska to Washington.
Huh.
Or to their headquarters, or competed for a line to get to Seattle so they could extend the call to Texas or wherever. They had seven lines.
Wow.
We had to compete for them.
Well, that must have made it challenging.
Well, Gravel's office really abused it. They had an office over here, and 90 degrees away was my office. If I left my door open, I could see anybody go in their office. And a lot of days, it was the Democratic Party officers going in and using the phone and conducting political business over the phone when they shouldn't have been, over sending the phone. Anyway, it got so bad that some of the agencies complained that they couldn't get one of the seven lines out of the state. So they did an unannounced audit one day. They found that Gravel's office was using five of the seven lines. Wow. If they'd kept it to Gravel's official business, it would have been different, but I mean, they're party officers. I knew all these guys. I knew who they were. I'd just say, hi, Sam. Hi, Colleen. Hi, as they go in. Yeah, they really abused it.
Now, what about private residence? People in Fairbanks, if you lived in your own home and you wanted to call long distance, could you do that?
Yes, there were phones.
It wasn't... These seven lines were just the government lines.
The GSA, Government Services Administration.
Okay.
GSA lines.
So those were different than a regular long distance line.
I could have called and paid for the call myself.
Yeah.
But those were put there for our convenience to get our casework back to.
So that's why the party people were using Gravel's, because it was free.
For party business.
Otherwise, at home, they would have had to pay for the call.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, I get it. I just wanted to clarify that. Well, I've heard that Gravel and Stevens did not get along very well with each other.
No, that's what I heard, too. But I never saw...
Oh, you never saw it?
No, I never saw. I never went to Washington.
Okay.
I just stayed here. We had finally got a fax machine. We probably had the first fax machine in Fairbanks about 1971 or two.
Wow. That's pretty early. No, well, you started in 1970 or 72, you said.
72, yeah.
So you got a fax machine a couple of years after that?
Yeah, about 74.
Okay.
Not sure.
Yeah. And then... Were there computers by the time you left, or you left before computers?
Left before computers. It's all electric, IBM electric typewriters.
Those electric typewriters.
We thought we were really sharp having a fax machine.
Yeah. So what were some other issues? You worked with the constituents to solve problems. That's a very special...
It was the time of the... I'm not sure when it was, but the oil embargo by OPEC was lifted. But before that, we were running out of... You know, they wouldn't allow Alaska to import oil.
Right, export oil.
Import, yeah. And... first part of March 1968 made a huge discovery up there.
Right.
When that came on, it was the largest oil province in the world.
And that was Atlantic Richfield, wasn't it, ARCO?
What?
Was it ARCO?
ARCO.
Yeah, Atlantic Richfield Company.
Mm-hmm. It was bigger than Saudi Arabia. Well, that changed the conversation.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And that's when Vice President Agnew was called into the Senate to cast a divided vote. He cast the 51st vote.
On what?
On pipeline permit.
Okay.
In the meantime,
the TAPS bill, that's right.
The contractors here had years earlier, had lined up equipment and personnel, because they knew they had a huge project ahead of them. They had built a road, had built a pipeline. So they had equipment they'd been stomping at the bit to get going. And when Agnew finally signed the permit that opened the gates, and they went up there and got started. Mm-hmm. Real hectic days.
Yeah.
And then people flooded into Fairbanks.
Yeah.
It was almost impossible to find a place to live. No phones, could get phones.
It was a crazy time in Fairbanks, huh?
It was a hectic time. Mm-hmm. Very hectic. So we worked through that, and while all this was going on, Alyeska was stomping at the bit also to get going. In order for them to start the laying pipe, had to have a way to get there, so they had to deal with the state and the oil companies. And the natives decided to form coalitions, and they blocked it.
That's the Land Claims Settlement Act. The Native Land Claims Settlement Act.
Yeah, that's part of the...
Yeah. They held things up for a while.
Yeah, that was their bargaining shit back in 70, 71.
Right.
They would no longer oppose it if the Congress, let's see, they... Kind of fuzzy to go back that long.
I know. Well, they wanted to have ownership of their own lands.
So yeah, they didn't want anybody to go up there and take caribou.
Yeah.
Not even one. So they were part of the delay. But the Greenies were part of the delay. Delaying the road.
Right.
The oil companies didn't want various people driving up there unless they were an engineer working on a job or something like that. The federal government didn't want to deal with traffic. So there was, I think there were five different groups, the state and the feds, the operators, natives. Anyway, they finally, after Agnew signed that, broke that tie, things opened up and it was just really hectic.
Yeah, I think the bill in Congress was the Trans-Alaska Pipeline something act.
Yeah.
It's the TAPS, Trans-Alaska Pipeline Services.
So then, once the blockade was gone, things... The town just got full of new people, new vehicles. And I, as a representative of Ted, would have to go to a lot of meetings between Alyeska and the state, Alyeska and the Native Coalition, Alyeska and some of the operators. And that I took up a lot of my time.
Yeah. And then you would take notes at the meetings and back and tell Senator Stevens what happened?
Mm-hmm.
Because you couldn't speak on his behalf if they wanted...
No, unless he authorized me to.
Yeah.
No, I would never speak for him. Ever.
Yeah. Well, you must have been good at getting things done, helping all those constituents.
I knew so many people in town.
You know how to work things to help people. That's a talent.
Yeah, after meetings like that, I would go back to office and type up the critical points. And Senator Stevens had telephone numbers for the CEOs of all these outfits. Mm-hmm. I'd send the issues, who supported it, who didn't, and that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
And then he'd take care of it from the other end, because he could get on the phone and call one of those guys and break a log jam.
Right.
And he knew all the native leaders, and I got to know a lot of them, too.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
So did you travel around to villages and things?
I did some, not as much as I'd like to, but I accompanied him on a lot of trips. I would set the trips up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I figured you probably arranged them, but I didn't know. Yeah. You went with him sometimes.
Sometimes. Not every time.
Do you have one in particular you remember?
Oh, they're all pretty similar.
So can you describe sort of a typical trip?
Well, if you went to a place like Tok, then I'd have a folder for him. It'd give all the information I had in it, what it was about and who was going to be there, and so, with some phone numbers, maybe. And if he was going down there in Senate business, he'd also take care of a constituent complaint or something. Go off to the side, meet with the guy, or take another 10 minutes, go into the coffee shop with him. Even though he couldn't solve it, you know, the fact that he was at Sister Tok, for example, would leave the meeting, just excuse himself, go maybe, now this is, I'm not describing any one incident.
No, it's a general.
But how it operated, and go in there maybe for 10 minutes, and Joe, Mr. Tok was sitting there, because I'd already arranged with him, I said, go over there and sit at that table, and when I can get him to come in here, I'll just get him over there. So we'd walk in the door, and I'd say, take the senator over, and they'd over, and they'd sit down, and, you know, half the guys in Tok would get together for coffee clutches every morning. And so the next day, all of the area of the Altair knew that the senator had been, had a private meeting with Mr. Tok. But they'd talk business, and Ted would collect the man's notes, and I'd sit in on them, a lot of them. I mean, that was kind of a typical trip out.
Well, I would think that meeting personally with a constituent would go a long way to making that person feel listened to, and that they would like a senator who does that.
Exactly.
And Alaska was a small enough state.
Yeah, and by the time we got to Tok, he knew who the sheriff, we don't have a sheriff, who the marshal's name was, and I think they had a municipal government then, and who was on that, who the people are who wanted to meet with him. And there's just a limit to what he could do.
Yeah, but you did all that background research.
I did that in advance.
And then briefed him before he went, right?
Oh, yeah, he'd have a folder on each trip.
That's great.
And if he was coming into Fairbanks for the weekend or something, we'd take advantage of every stop.
Yeah.
Could stop this place and go out the front door and go down to the bank and say hello to Bill Stroker, and you know, and the next day, I talked to Ted yesterday, even though it was just high.
Yeah.
But he was very good at that.
Yes. Well, you must have been very good at managing all that. That's a lot.
Yeah, you had to manage it.
That's a lot to manage for somebody. Well, eventually, did you get other staff to help, or was it always just you?
No, just me. I never went to Washington until after I quit. Then they said, well, you got to come back to Washington. I said, what for? Well, you worked for me for 7 years. You should make at least one trip.
Yeah.
I could have gone back every month or so. He picked up the tab. But yeah. I don't like to take advantage of the government. I don't have to.
Yeah. Well, you probably had your hands full here.
More to do than I could do.
Yeah. Well, and I do know that constituent stuff is
it's very,
very private.
Very stressful and private.
Yeah, so I understand
Well, this man Libby reminded me of.
Yeah.
He worked for his Department of Labor. They had some federal rules and regs, and he met everything, and he'd been approved, and it never came through. So he came in, and pretty sad. I said, well, come on back. We had two offices. And I said, come on back here and we can get some more privacy. So he told me his problem. So I got on the phone. I said, well, I'll call Seattle Department of Labor. We'll talk. Faxed him something and got it solved on the phone.
That's great.
And the man was sitting outside the desk, and I hung up.
He must have been very appreciative.
Oh, yeah. He was sitting here listening to the whole conversation. I said, if you want to listen, you can. Oh, he said, I'll just sit here. They said, we'll take care of that. And I said, can you call me back in 10 minutes or something? Call me back. Said, Mrs. Dalton? Yes. Talked to so-and-so. We've reviewed his request, reviewed his problem, and I think we can take care of that. So the other guy comes on the phone and said, this is Mr. So-and-so. Yes, we've been working on that case a long time. I said, I know you've been working on that case a long time. This man has reached the end of his rope pretty much. Can you take care of it and get it done? Take it out of the file cabinet or take it out of that basket in your desk. He said, well, we can do that. He said, I'll talk to the caseworker this afternoon. He said, we'll get something in the mail tomorrow. Wow. So this man was sitting there. He could hear us talking, and he just broke down and cried right there. And finally I said, you know, I got something to do in the other office. I've got to make some calls and do such. He said, why don't you just sit here for a while? And so I let him cry it out. And he walked out of there a happy man, but he still saw me. So he just had met the end of his rope.
Yeah.
And he just totally...
That shows the power of a senator's office.
Yeah. That was just a case.
That you could make things happen.
Could make things happen. When we called from Fairbanks, this is Senator Ted Stevens' office in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I have a constituent here who has a problem, and we have been working with your office for 6 months or 3 months, and this is the case number, and this is the issue. Can you help me? Can we talk this out? Sometimes I couldn't. I'd run into a roadblock. Mm-hmm. But I'd have enough information. I'd say, well, I think I have enough information here that I'll fax it to the senator's office in the morning. Because 7 o'clock here was 11 mm-hmm. o'clock there.
Right.
And so the fact that I was sending all that to the senator got him moving.
That got him moving. Yeah, I would think you'd have to be very persistent and strong-minded for that job.
You had to be very polite. I had to understand what you were doing. Had to be polite to them.
But you had to be forceful, too, probably. Mm-hmm. And persistent to keep trying.
That's just a joke, you know, the gossip and the coffee.
Oh, I know.
That's with a couple of friends of mine.
No, it's a good joke.
But it's fun.
It's fun. You need to have entertainment. So we've gone just about an hour. You ready to take a break? Or is there anything else you want
to
say?
I'd like to finish up with Ted Stevens.
Okay, let's keep going then.
So since I had lived in the Arctic for about 7 years, almost 7 years, when major events were happening or major visitors, I'd try to get up there. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have a budget for anything like that, to find my own way. Going north to Prudhoe Bay was a challenge getting a ride because there was no commercial airline yet. And the Stevens office had no budget for anything like that. So I would talk to him about doing something or going to a certain event up there. He said, well, yeah, go ahead. Fine with me if you can find your way up there. Like, don't ask me to spend any money on you. Just go do what you can do. So I did a lot of that. And in March of 68, when ARCO announced their discovery, I managed to get a seat on the air. It was a DC-3 taking a group of people up, the governor and the commissioner of oil and gas and all the bigwigs. And I managed to get on the board that flight. And going south from Prudhoe south was always easier to get a ride because any freight or personnel going up took the seat, but going south it was empty.
Yeah.
So that's how I managed my transportation.
When you got on that flight in 1968, you were working for the News Miner?
No, I was working for Ted.
Okay. I thought you started working for Ted later than that.
I wasn't working for Ted yet.
You may have been a reporter still.
Yeah, I was. Lost track of...
So you worked for Ted...
But I did a lot of reporting for the Arctic, for the News Miner.
Right. We'll talk about that another time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's finish up with Ted. So you worked for Ted from 70 to 79 or 70...
Through 78.
78, okay.
And then I had the good sense to quit. I was really stressed out. It was so much work to do.
I was going to ask if you found the job enjoyable.
Job what?
Did you like the job? Did you find it enjoyable?
Oh, I loved it. But I was still, in 68, I was still working for the News Miner. And I did a lot of stories for them when they were trying to get a bridge across the Yukon. Tremendous project.
Yeah.
I would hitch a ride up and do a story, hitch a ride home.
But you liked working for Senator Stevens?
Yes, I did. I liked it very much. It's a challenging job. Because you have to be on your toes, you have to know what you're doing, you have to know the issues, you have to study the issues.
Yeah.
And since you work for the senator, you have to be very careful about what you say. You don't tell people. You're very straightforward. Deal in facts. But if there was a real hot gossip item that would affect something, I'd let Senator know about that. But I didn't circulate in the social circles. I was too busy working.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would make sense if there was some gossip going around, he might need to be aware of it. So if somebody asked him, he would know how to answer.
I'd let him follow up on it.
Yeah. You were just giving him the facts.
Or one of his chief of staff or somebody else. Yeah. Oh, he had contacts all over the state.
Yeah.
I was just one of his contacts.
Well, you were the Fairbanks person.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arctic person.
Then he had an office in Anchorage.
Somebody must be here. The dog's barking.
I don't know what he's working at.
Izzy, knock it off.
There's been a raven flying by.
Somebody's coming in.
Come on, Izzy.
That's Isabel.
Isabel. Stop, wild dog.
Come on, Izzy.
What breed is she, Libby?
She's a Chesapeake.
Chesapeake.
Yeah.
Chesapeake Bay Retriever.
Yep. Stop. She's very loud.
Come here, Izzy. Is it?